If you've seen my previous videos, then this blow lamp will be familiar. The ancestor of the modern blowtorch that dates back to the Renaissance and is simply an oil lamp that the user blows on with a specially designed pipe. These incredibly useful tools were a mainstay of workshops and laboratories for centuries. And in a continued effort to see what the blow lamp is capable of, in this video, I'll attempt to build and use a particularly powerful model of blow lamp from the 1800s to see if I can finally pull off practical old-school glassworking in my workshop. Glassworkers in the medieval period made use of giant furnaces to achieve the high temperatures required to melt glass. The 11th century monk Theophilus left behind detailed descriptions of these furnaces and their use in his manuscript On Diverse Arts. The amount of energy he suggests is required is frankly astonishing. For many glass objects, especially smaller, intricately detailed ones, this reflected a huge waste of resources to fire up such a giant furnace. With the advent of the much more efficient blow lamp in the Renaissance, the earliest accounts of which appear in Murano, Venice, the glassworking heart of Italy, this changed. Rather than using a small amount of the energy in a large fire, artisans could use a large amount of the energy in a small fire, the flame of an oil lamp. This democratization of energy created new cottage industries, which flourished in the 1600s and that would persist for centuries. Many artisans, leaving the furnaces behind, would work from their own homes, making everything from beads and artificial jewels to even alchemical glassware and delicate scientific instruments. Despite building multiple of these lamps, as to yet, I've had very little success working glass with these devices. Luckily, an invention in the early 1800s called the continuous blowpipe might just be what I need to succeed in this endeavor, so I'm going to try to reconstruct it from scrap copper. As my previous struggles illustrate, despite the democratization of energy the blow lamp enabled, glassworking still presented challenges. This is no surprise, as glassworking not only requires a lot of energy, but also requires a high degree of concentration, and is one of the few mediums that involves shaping fluid matter at near molten temperatures. Along with this, the blow lamp itself requires a fair bit of concentration, especially the larger ones used for glassworking. They required a lot of air, and when using their own lungs, glassworkers could easily find themselves exhausted fairly rapidly. To be successful, cottage industries would rely on a whole family working together, typically with air to each lamp supplied by a bellows under the table, usually worked by one member of the family. The continuous blowpipe automates away the need for a family and replaces your children with technology. I've been unable to determine a specific inventor for this device, but multiple sources I've read describe similar balloon-based continuous blowpipes, one being T.P. Danger's The Art of Glassblowing, and the other Michael Faraday's Chemical Manipulation, a favorite of this channel. Both say the continuous blowpipe is typically made by a professional device maker, but both also offer instructions to build makeshift versions at home. For this project, I'll try to make something in between, certainly not professional, but more durable than something just thrown together. The first crucial part is just the stand for the device. I'm making mine with an adjustable mount to hold the blowpipe, based on the same principle as a common chemistry stand. As for the base, I'm going to reuse the wooden C-clamp I made in my previous blow lamp video. The clamp worked great, but the stand itself wasn't phenomenal, so it will get a second chance at life here. The trick behind the device is really simple. You basically just attach a balloon to the blowpipe to act as a reservoir of air that will blow for you. However, to keep the balloon full, a one-way valve is needed so that you can add air in without it blowing right back out. Before we get to the valve though, I'll first just build a receptacle for the balloon to mount on my stand. Danger says the balloon should be oriented beneath the table, and actually suggests placing it between the user's legs, so that the glassworker can apply additional air pressure to the system with their thighs. Though it sounds a little silly, it's these little places where the maker's moment-to-moment muscular inputs can make fine adjustments to the flame that I think the real art of the blow lamp comes through. Like all old tools, it's an extension of the user. and as an artist's muscle memory develops and they form a connection with the device, it will go from a simple lamp to a precision tool. To route air from the balloon to the pipe, I'm going to use a length of latex tubing. Though flexible tubing may seem like a distinctly modern material, latex is far older than modern polymers and is excreted naturally by many plants. Faraday used natural latex frequently in his lab, and it draws its origins back to Mesoamerica, where it was collected and used by Mesoamerican people like the Aztecs. To do a preliminary test of the device, I'm going to forgo the valve and just see what the balloon can do on its own. The nozzle of the blowpipe acts like a regulator, only allowing so much air out at any moment. I was impressed by how stable a flame it was able to produce, far more constant and unwavering than I would be able to make with my own lungs. Now that we know it should work, I'm going to make the valve. Danger and Faraday suggest two different ways to make their makeshift valves, but because Faraday seems more straightforward, I'm going to go with something more akin to his. It's as simple as a strip of material stretched loosely over the hole of a tube. Blowing from behind the tube pushes the material up, letting air through, which produces a silly noise. Whereas blowing against the tube flattens the material against the hole, choking off airflow. Faraday just ties a strip of cloth to a tube and jams it in a balloon. But to make mine more stable, I'm going to give it a more permanent valve casing so that it can work in line with the rest of the device. This valve will allow me to blow through it with my own lungs and fill the balloon, whereas the balloon's pressure will otherwise seal the valve without my breath to open it. These valves were nothing new in the 1800s, and similar valve technology has been used to gather and trap air in blacksmith bellows for a very long time. A simple Y-joint will connect all three components together, the balloon, the valve, and the blowpipe. It's an exceedingly simple system, and will allow me to keep a continuous jet of flame stable, potentially for hours on end. A test of the full setup is a complete success. Not only is the flame so stable that this shot might as well be a photograph, but the balloon can easily be refilled, just by blowing on the valve. I can already completely understand the widespread popularity of these devices. They were so popular, in fact, that you can still find modern versions of this tool in glass workshops to this day. The pencil tip of this oil lamp is just the beginning of what this device can do, and I built this with a mind to invigorate the flame of a much more powerful lamp. Rather than a quarter-inch wick, I'd like to move up to a circular wick at least larger than half an inch in diameter. Danger says glass-working lamps can have wicks as large as 2 inches in diameter. And while that's tempting, I'm going to start with something less insane. Also, my more powerful lamp will be built to burn spirit rather than oil. Spirit lamps were common in laboratories in the 1800s, but the high cost of fuel prohibited their use in glassblowing. That said, it's cheaper nowadays, and because I'm a complete novice to this and have never really worked glass before, the advantages the more expensive spirit fuel will bring will probably help dampen the learning curve somewhat. For the uninitiated, in today's day, spirit commonly refers to some kind of distilled alcohol, typically ethyl alcohol. However, in the past, spirit could refer to basically any distilled liquid, though typically the term referred to either acidic or flammable distillates. This comes from the very early history of alchemy, when to distill something was thought to be the act of separating that thing's spirit from its body, the evaporating liquid moving like a ghost, containing the fiery essence of the original body. This was likely a holdover from ancient animism, believing that minerals and substances had spirits. However, how literally alchemists throughout history have believed themselves to have been separating spirits varies alchemist to alchemist, but the term spirit was popular enough that it remains in use today. The main reason spirit was used in lamps was because typically these low boiling point distillates burned cleanly, leading to a more pure flame free of superfluities. This is because they are normally small molecules that burn more completely with less oxygen than the large molecules in oil. That said, The clean flame can sometimes appear almost ethereal and ghost-like, which only furthers the spirit metaphor. I'm going to be using isopropyl alcohol for the time being, which is commonly called rubbing alcohol, and is essentially just propane, with a single hydroxyl molecule stapled to it, making it a liquid alcohol, rather than a gaseous alkane. The small molecule size of spirits leads to them being less viscous than oil, and allows them to leak through porous substances easily. Just like a ghost, spirit would pass through the walls of my terracotta oil lamp. So instead, I'm going to use a recycled glass jar to hold my fuel. Because the intense heat of the wick could easily crack the glass, unlike my oil lamps, this spirit lamp can't just let its wick rest on its rim, and needs the copper wick holder to help support the wick and distribute its intense heat. Though I will use solder where I'm confident it won't melt, the heat this lamp will experience requires the design of the wick holder to basically go together without it, which was a bit of a fun design challenge. I've been meaning to make a spirit lamp like this for a while, as beyond just glasswork, they played a central role in chemical laboratories over the past few centuries. Because of their clean flame, they were in many ways the predecessor of the Bunsen burner, and were crucial to the delicate analysis processes that could be ruined by soot or smoking oil. Though the diameter of the wick holder is only twice that of my smaller oil lamp, it can fit about 5 of the oil lamp's wicks in a bundle, making it not twice as strong, but around 5 times as powerful as the smaller lamp. This is why I thought a 2-inch wick would be a little ridiculous. Once bundled up and filled with 99% isopropanol, the lamp is ready to test. The intensity of the flame depends a lot on the height of the wick, but I can already feel the increase in energy just by the heat of the lamp alone. Interestingly, in daylight, when the flame is invigorated by the blow lamp, the spirit fire is rendered almost invisible. Just like with any other ghost, our spirit lamp only shows its true self in the dark of night. Though it was spooky to be down in the woods in the workshop late at night, I figured it was worth it to be able to see the flame while learning to use it. As I worm the glass tube in the flame, a fiery orange aurora appears around the glass, dimly at first, but as it goes, it increases in intensity. This is the ionization of sodium in the glass, and it continues to get brighter as the glass gets hotter. Eventually, it's bright enough to light up my workbench in the dead of night, and at its brightest, the glass is clearly melting, and the tube is warping and bulging as I turn it in the flame. To protect their eyes and see through this light, glass workers typically wear sodium flare glasses. You can see at this phase, a red-orange glow is diffusing through the glass. Though it serves as the glass beneath the flare, we can see it due to optical effects in the edges of the tubes. It's clear my new blow lamp is capable of heating glass to workable temperatures, but now the question is if I can actually learn to use it. I'd like to start with something very simple, the common laboratory practice of making an ampoule, aka a sealed glass vessel, out of a test tube. Though it's probably the simplest thing I could have chosen to do, it still took me hours to learn the process, which involves stretching a test tube until it narrows dramatically in the middle. As you can tell by the daylight and shattered glass on my workbench, I have been working at this for a while now. But by my 5th attempt, I was feeling like I was starting to get somewhere. The goal of an ampoule is to create something called a hermetic seal. Today, this just means an airtight seal. But like most everything we've talked about today, the origins of the hermetic seal are in historical alchemical practice. Many alchemists were followers of a sort of religious system known as Hermeticism, which claimed Hermes Trismegistus as the original alchemist. Because of this, they were called hermetics. An important step in the supposed process of creating the philosopher's stone was to seal the ingredients in a glass flask called the hermetic egg. This couldn't just be a simple seal, it had to be perfect, so alchemists melted the glass neck of the flask in what they called the hermetic seal. Exactly the same type of seal modern chemists use with ampoules to stir reactive, fragile, or dangerous chemicals that either need to be protected from the environment or have the environment protected from them. I think my impatience made this process take far longer than it should have. Despite this, I started to figure out how to stretch the glass, and finally, after multiple failed attempts, I had the neck of the ampule firmed. Now, the last step is to actually seal something inside of it. I don't really plan on making anything so dangerous it requires an ampule, nor am I trying to make the Philosopher's Stone, but I figured a fun test would be a little ammonia solution, which I'll try to seal in one of the earlier ampule attempts. Ammonia doesn't require an ampule, nor is it really a good fit to be kept in one, as the alkaline nature of ammonia will react with the silica in the glass over time. The reason I chose it is because it smells horrible. Ammonia solution off-gasses a lot of ammonia gas, which reacts with the water in your nose to form caustic ammonium hydroxide, which will actually burn the inside of your nose. If only a little is present, you'll detect it as a discomforting urine-like odor, but if there's enough, it will just smell like pain. Because of this, it's a great candidate to test if my hermetic seal is truly airtight, as if there's even a tiny leak, I should be able to smell the ammonia. To make the seal, I just have to melt the ampule's thin neck with the pencil flame of the torch, drawing it out till it splits the ampule in two, leaving me with a hermetically sealed vial. Though it's just a simple thing, finally seeing a functional piece of glass come out of my blow lamp endeavors feels like a success, and I certainly intend to keep practicing with both glass and the other abilities of the continuous blowpipe to see where it can go. The ampule works perfectly, and my nose can't even detect a trace of ammonia around the vial. Just the slightly sweet scent of isopropanol, and a hint of the coppery smell of my own hands after a day in the workshop. With that, I'm going to end this video here. Thanks for watching. If you enjoyed this video, please consider subscribing. And if you know anyone who might like it, sharing this video can go a long way in helping my channel. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, please feel free to comment below. Thanks again, and bye!